It's my impression over the years that Mr. Crusoe was a rather formidable, not opponent, but a formidable adversary if he wanted to be.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And of course, you know, I was pretty naive. I didn't realize that, you know, others were looking at us kind of with such envy and such jealousy that, yes. You know, here we were. We, as I say, we were a totally autonomous group. We didn't fit the pattern of any of the other vehicle divisions. And I don't think we were cocky or full of ourselves, but we were self-confident.
Right.
And, you know, I think the fact that we'd been vindicated with our own design against some pretty tough opposition, I think gave us confidence in ourselves. And we thought that we knew our product better than somebody like Louis Crusoe knew our product. And that we knew what we wanted to do, and that was the course that we were staying on. People were starting to snipe at us. It got towards the end, it got totally political, which was, you know, unfortunate, yeah. But, you know, in the early days, we were all gung-ho, and as I say, I was naive enough to think that, you know, what we did and what we did best was the best thing for the Ford Motor Company, and who was going to quarrel with that? I didn't realize the jealousies that some of the other people had, that they wanted to usurp us and make us part of their empire.
Mm-hmm. So Mr. Crusoe was indeed a formidable adversary at that point.
Oh yeah, sure. As a matter of fact, one of the things that, you know, still sticks in my craw was the development of the original Thunderbird.
Mm-hmm.
It was conceived after we had started the Continental Mark II project, and the original T-Bird, as approved by the product committee of the company, had the old, remember Crown Victoria roof called a basket handle that came, that was the roof that was on the T-Bird.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the way the T-Bird was approved. Crusoe sent one of his guys, and Chase Morrissey was the person that it was.
Yes.
Sent him over. I didn't know he was there, but he got into our design studio, saw our roof, took the design of that roof and put it on the T-Bird. And this just galled me. I mean, I was really seeing fire. And this is where I first started my fallout with Louis Crusoe.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a design committee meeting, not of the Mark II, but of some other company products. And the T-Bird came up, and I told him right in the meeting, I said, look, if you're a little short of tracing paper, we can lend you some. You've got this great big, and he had the whole design studio under him. You know, he had hundreds of people, and I had this little group of,
party band.
A dozen or so guys, and they'd swiped our design, and they were going to come to production first because they were a going entity, and we still had to build our plant and go through that thing. And it, you know, it still bothers me to this day that the corporate-wise, I guess I've got to look at it as probably a good thing, that the T-Bird was a success, and you know, the roof was part of it, but it's still our roof.
What was Crusoe's reaction? Did you get any reaction?
Oh, his little beady eyes sparkled, and he said, well, you don't have any proprietary interest in anything that's designed in this company. And I said, well, I think I do if it's done in my division. And that was the beginning of our falling out. Mm-hmm. And, when I told him he could use some tracing paper, if he was really that hard up for designers, that didn't sit well at all, and everybody heard it.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a special meeting, and I requested a special meeting. I said, look, this guy stole my design. I want the T-Bird and I want the Continental brought in front of both of you, full-size models.
Right.
And you look at him and see if he hasn't swiped my roof and whether it isn't going to hurt, you know, hurt my car. And we did. We had a meeting like that. And Jack Davis, I think, was the guy who, resolved it, for lack of a better word. He said, there's no question there's a similarity, but the cars are so different in size and in concept that I don't think it's going to hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I wasn't particularly pleased with the outcome, but that's the way it was ultimately resolved.
Mm, the diplomatic.
That was Jack's solution to the thing, to supposedly keep everybody happy. Crusoe was happy, I wasn't.
Yeah, but did you go on then to another design?
That's the design that's on that car, with the blind rear quarter, because the T-Bird never had the blind rear quarter. It had that
right.
basket handle Victoria roof.
And, exactly.
But as you remember, the bird that came out, well, a year, they beat us into production by a year, and that had the blind quarter on that roof.
Right. Yeah.
And then the next year, they stuck a porthole in it.
Another Crusoe innovation.
That's right.
You couldn't see how to, the the design was pretty much frozen by this point.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
All the approvals been
right.
given, and you were satisfied.
Yeah.
So
one of the details, I mean, not to belabor another point, but one of the things that that we spent an enormous amount of time on, I remember very well because I took one of the prototypes you referred to earlier. I took one home on Christmas Eve, showed to my mother.
Yes.
And the thing that we'd spent, I don't know how many hours, was the hood ornament.
Mm-hmm.
And we labored over that hood ornament. I wanted something that was readily identifiable, like the Rolls Royce, like the Mercedes Star. You didn't need to see a name. You knew what it was. I mean, once you saw it, that's a Rolls, that's a Mercedes. I said, I want this for our car. I don't want people to have to look to see, you know, what is that? Once they see that emblem, okay, that's a Lincoln Continental, or that's a Continental Mark II, or whatever the terminology was going to be at the time. So, just as an example of the attention that we paid to detail, the hood ornament was one of our big hang-ups. And as I say, I had this thing put on a cobbled up car, Lincoln sheet metal, and drove my mother around it, and we had her critique the hood ornament.
What did you think?
She liked it.
Uh-huh.
She liked it.
Now, was that the final one?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The four of the
yeah. Heck, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The star. Mm-hmm.
It was a beautiful job. Was that somebody on the staff who came up with that?
I think Bob Thomas had the most to do with that.
Did he?
Yeah.
You've gone through several prototypes in terms of coming before you came to that prototype.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah, we went through, you know, the whole, and the same thing with the needles on the speedometer. And we had a tack on there, which was unusual in those days to put a tack on a car. And we wanted the hands to look like they were the hands of a Cartier watch. I mean, we really wanted the needles to be fine. And so there was more attention paid to detail in that car than, you know, anything that I've ever been exposed to before or since.
Wasn't great fun.
It was, and half the fun was laboring over, is this the right shape needle for the
right.
speedometer, and, you know, does the door handle feel right, and does the ashtray open correctly, and everything about it was fun. The leathers that we picked for the interiors, you know, all of the detail that goes into a car that nowadays we take pretty much for granted, but we were lucky in that we got involved in all of that. I was lucky that I got involved in all of that.
Well, everybody that I've talked to who was involved with it, Gordon and Reinhardt, and I hope to talk to Harley sometime.
Yeah, I hope you do.
I'm going out there later this year, and I'll try to get contact. It was a gorgeous experience. I mean, the esprit de corps you mentioned, the camaraderie, pride of achievement, the fact that you did it perhaps a little out of the mainstream of the company.
Yeah, totally out of the mainstream.
And that you came up with something that was unique really, for that period.
Mm-hmm.
How did you have to swing the new production plant? There must have been some opposition to that.
Well, there was and there wasn't. It clearly wasn't, because it was so unique, it clearly wasn't going to fit into any existing assembly plant that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was really, the plant came out of necessity. We had to build our own assembly plant.
There even a room in
there. No, there wasn't. Plus our whole paint system was unique. Mm-hmm. We were putting many more coats and we were using a different kind of lacquer, and nothing fitted into any of the existing facilities at that time.
Who was your paint supplier, by the way? Do you remember?
I think it was Wrenchhead Mason.
Right. No, I'm assuming it was. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He came up with very special concoctions.
Right.
For me.
Right.
The when the Continental Division, where the you came up with the special product operation announcement in '53. When was the Continental Division organized and announced?
Well, we got, I can't tell you who did it. I think it was Dick Morris, who was my public relations
right.
guy. there was a Lincoln Continental Owners Club, and he formed a, well, an association, a relationship with them. And we sort of worked out that probably their annual meeting would be a great place to announce the fact that they're, mm-hmm. in fact, Ford Motor Company was coming out with a new Continental. Mm-hmm. And so in conjunction with them, we had an elaborate dinner all planned out. John Daly was the master of ceremonies, mm-hmm. and oh, we had a big function. And
I've seen some pictures.
Yeah, and internally, we discussed it and asked them whether, you know, they thought this was an appropriate time for the company to make an announcement. Everybody thought, sure, this was fine, go ahead and do it that way, if that's the way you want to do it. So that's when we announced that there would be a Continental car coming out, and then right after that we changed the name of the division to the Continental division.
There'd never been any thought in your mind at the beginning that it was called anything but Continental?
No. Because it was unique. I mean, it wasn't a, you know, the dealers had always said the Mercury was a cobbled up Ford, and you know, this wasn't a cobbled up anything. This was a totally unique vehicle.
Dick Morris's, if I assume it was his, public relations campaign for the announcement and the background of it was a masterpiece. Some of that material that he
put together. Dick and Doug McClure worked very closely on all of that promotional material.
And who had the idea of it to be called the Mark II? That came about, obviously, out of the service,
there. Well, I'm not so sure that Ray Hultz wasn't the guy that came up with that. I may be wrong. I remember we used to have a, you know, staff meeting.
Sure.
All of these people that you mentioned. Yeah. And we would meet once a week, and, you know, we got around to names. And we kicked it around, you know, should it be Lincoln Continental? Well, nobody really thought it should be, because there'd been a hiatus between the last one.
Right. And you really weren't part of the Lincoln.
No, and we weren't part of the Lincoln. Well, actually, at that time, there was just the Lincoln Mercury division. There wasn't a separate Lincoln division at that time. Somebody in one of our staff meetings said, well, what do you think of the Mark designation? Of course, all of us said, well, you know, it's a military thing. Mm-hmm. Well, let's assume that the car that my father did was the Mark One, and let's Mark Two. Well, okay, sounded good. And I remember again taking it to the policy committee here at the company, and Red Duffy, of course, had been a colonel in the Army, procurement. Well, you know, Mark, we use that for tanks and things, you know, rifles and stuff like that. And we said, yeah, but you know, what does it mean in the military? Well, it's a, you know, it's an advanced, very well. I said, exactly. That's what we've got. We've got a. So, you know, that's how it was born. Everybody thought it was strange, but they couldn't think of any reason why it shouldn't be called that. Mm-hmm. So, okay, well, you know.
Worked out for you.
Yeah. Call it the Mark II. So we did.
So you've got the official designation, you've got the official approval, and you're ready to go into production.
Right.
Any problems then that you would call? Production.
Yes, a lot of, well, the car was so unique, just in the, we'd accumulated, well, by word of mouth, and I went around the country, and so did a lot of the other guys with pictures, mm-hmm. and we had cocktail parties and receptions, and we'd show them to people, and we had a pretty good backlog of orders. Mm-hmm. One of the problems was, you know, how do we ship the car? It had to be delivered in mint condition. We didn't want it rattling around the hallways, and good Lord, we had these fleece-lined bags that we were packing the cars in and putting them on the hallways, and well, they didn't fit the hallways just right because of the wheelbase, and there were a million problems associated with getting the cars out. Paint obviously had to be right. We had problems with the paint, orange peel, and that kind of effect, but they all got smoothed out. The prototypes were good cars. We had our own little mini test track behind our plant.
Did you?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And we had railroad ties, and we had a water bath, and we had all those things in there. Cobblestone ride. It was a little quarter mile track, and we drive the cars around on that. And so we were fully integrated. We really had everything.
Mm-hmm. Charlie DeVos was your production man at that time?
Yep, he was, yep.
And he must have had a myriad of problems to begin with.
Well, he did. He had problems with the whole plant layout, and I think probably his biggest problem was dealing with us who had no experience at all. You know, didn't know what he was talking about at the time. Charlie really, by nature, was not too articulate. And I remember the first meeting we had, he started out and he had a blackboard and he said, well, there are 365 days in the year. Well, I wasn't going to quarrel with that. I thought, what the hell is he talking about? And then he said, well, okay, then you subtract weekends. And then you take away, you know, vacation time and downtime. And you do this, and he ended up with 200 working days in a year on the assembly line. And if we produce, you know, X number of cars per day, then we will have our annual production. Well, it was fine. I mean, it was the ABCs of doing it, but you know, when we started out there 365 days in a year, I thought, this is our manufacturing guy. What is he getting at?
He thought he was lecturing to a group of...
I didn't know what he was doing.
Secondary students.
Exactly. Or, you know, grade school, second grade. I thought I knew how many days there were in a year, but, you know, and then, when he finally got through, and we'd plan what our annual volume would be, and then he could figure out line speed and how many cars per day, and it all started to fall into place. But I think really one of his problems was educating us as much as it was, you know, doing the actual plant layout and all the other things that he had to do, which he did. He had, he hired a lot of other people too that helped him out with it, but he was our main guy that we relied on. Well, I might add, because I think it's important to the whole story, it's crucial to the whole story, really, that when our car was approved by the policy committee, it was never approved as a profit center. That it was considered to be three-dimensional advertising for the Ford Motor Company.
Right.
It would take the place of a four-color spread in Life magazine. And we got it financially to where we thought we could put it on a break-even basis, but even from day one, it was always projected as a loss.
Mm-hmm.
And that
in
lieu,
universal agreement.
Yeah, exactly. Those ground rules changed as we went along, and that's what led to one of the things that led to the demise of the division. But it was clearly stated in the initial paper that this was going to be corporate advertising, and this would fall under that umbrella, and that this would be. Well, it was my idea originally with the car. We'd always been chasing Cadillac, so to speak, and we're always a nickel short and a day late and behind them. And I said, why don't we go around them? You know, in those days, a $6,000 car was an expensive car. I said, let's just leapfrog them, and let's put this as a $10,000 car, which was an unheard of price in this country in those days.
Scared the hell out of everybody.
Yeah. And this is what we'll do, and this will, we don't have to worry about chasing Cadillac. We've established a new pinnacle. Then we will be sitting up there, and everybody thought that was a pretty good idea. So that was kind of the thinking that went on along, you know, behind the car, and really how the whole program got approved. That okay, this would be the Ford Motor Company's prestige car. It was a $10,000 car. It wasn't a Me Too Lincoln following a Cadillac, and that. You know, this aura of prestige would rub off on the other Ford Motor Company products, so therefore it really didn't have to make a profit. It was taking the place of a lot of corporate advertising we would have done in other fields.
Right.
So I mean, but that premise is key to subsequent events that happened to the division.
You introduced, I guess, in mid '55.
Yeah, we did, early fall of '55. Right.
And created Quest, or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had, we had showings, you know, all around the country. Again, we had a dog and pony show that we put on and went around, I think it was six or eight different cities, went around the country. And
Doug McClure would have you scheduled in.
Doug and Dick Morris and the rest of them would schedule us, and we'd be, you know, Los Angeles, Chicago, Dallas, San Francisco.
Would you fly car with you? I mean, would you?
The cars, I can't remember how they worked the cars. They had
logistics.
I think they had four cars. Two would be at the city we were going to, and then there two would be on a train going to the next place, and they'd just keep rotating them around.
Right.
And I think it was in Dallas. I almost had a heart attack. The cars were roped off in the ballrooms where we were showing them in the hotels. And there was a green, I may have the colors reversed, but it doesn't matter. And there was a green car that had the wrong color steering wheel on.
Mismatch?
Mismatch, okay. Total mismatch. And oh, I said, my God, what happened to this thing? Here was the interior, it's got almost, if it was a black interior, it's got a red steering wheel on the thing. Or vice versa, I can't remember what it was, except that it was a total mismatch on color. Well, fortunately, the ropes kept the people away from the cars pretty much, and nobody had a chance, and the light was either bad or good enough, depending on your point of view, so you couldn't really pick it out, and it wasn't that glaring a mistake. But nobody worried about stuff like that. There was a great battle when we first showed the car. Everybody wanted to have the first one.
Sure.
And Frank Sinatra, when we were in L.A., he had to have the first one. My mother's uncle, Leonard Firestone, he thought they were great. He had to have the first one in L.A. Well, how are we going to arrange two first cars in L.A.? We did that pretty well. We got two different dealers at different parts of the city.
Each one was the first one.
And you can deliver this at 12 o'clock, and you can deliver this at 12 o'clock. So the two cars got delivered simultaneously from two different dealerships. They both had the first car in Los Angeles.
Your father had a similar dilemma with the Model A, as you probably
know. I really didn't know that.
Doug and Mary Pickford wanted the first
one. Oh, really? Okay, it was the Hollywood bunch again. They always want the first.
Tom Edison wanted one of the first ones, too.
Oh, okay.
Well, it's a remarkable reception for a new product, a totally new product, I seem to recall.
Yes, it was. It was a great reception. Well, it was an innovative design, and I think it did all the things that we hoped it would do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a distinctive car, and I'm not blowing my own horn. I'm just reciting it, as I saw it.
Popular reception was fabulous, but so was a critical reception. We got nothing but kudos from the automobile.
That's right. Yeah, the Buff magazines and everything else gave us great reviews on the thing.
It must have been a very exciting time for me.
That was great. Unfortunately for me, it wasn't. Well, I'd injured myself pretty badly physically at that point. I'd broken my Achilles tendon.
That was when that happened.
Yeah, right? It happened. Oh,
late
Lord.
55,
yeah, just before Christmas in 55. The car had only been. I was playing paddle tennis. And it was, dead of winter, and I was playing outside, and it was cold, and this thing snapped, and that was, the car had only been on the road about 6 weeks at that time.
Yeah.
And,
it was out of circulation.
It sure did. I was in a hip cast and on crutches for about 7 months, and I couldn't get around. I didn't get to the office for a long time, and the whole thing was, it was terrible. And I guess, during my absence, that's when a lot of the infighting went on, a lot of the shooting down of the division started, and I wasn't there to protect my own interest.
Would you like to put any of that on record?
I'd
love to hear about how that gradually happened.
Well, it goes back to really to Louis Crusoe and his empire building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he wanted this as part of, he wanted the whole automotive side of Ford Motor Company, cars and trucks.
Did he have the tacit backing of Ernie Breach?
Well, he did really at that time. He was always sniping at us throughout this whole procedure. He was sniping at us. He was the only one who would get these little digs in all the time. Well, I go back to the Wild St. Clair, and I've seen cars like this come and go. And but his point was they'd always gone.
Yeah.
Luxury cars are fine. They're good for a while, but they don't last. These high-priced cars don't last. And then he'd recite chapter and verse. Well, I listened to him, I heard him, but I really didn't believe what he was saying because I felt that we had a car that would be a viable entity. But I guess he put on a full court press when I wasn't around. I guess the one of the, what was not a criticism of the Mark II per se, But one of the things that that our buyers wanted was a four-door model.
Mm-hmm.
And we started to work right away on the four-door. And as a matter of fact, when the Continental Division was folded, we had a four-door, we had the die model all made. We had the whole car was ready to go into production. We were ready to start making tools for it.
Mm-hmm.
So we would have had a four-door sedan model. We had a two-door and a four-door.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, we got shot down before we were ever able to put that into production.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but what was Henry's position in this, on all of this?
Well, this was 1956. Mm-hmm. It was the first year that the company went public with its stock.
Mm-hmm. He was busy with that.
He was busy with that, but there was also a fear that Ernie Breach expressed. Ernie was going to be the chairman of the first annual meeting.
Mm-hmm.
That some questions might be asked, you know, do you have any divisions that are losing money?
Mm-hmm.
And we were in the red. We were programmed to be in the red. This was nothing out of the ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
But he was afraid that some shareholder might raise hell if, you know, is the Continental Division making a profit? Well, how do I answer that? And really, it was, again, they were in uncharted waters. The company had never been public before.
Right. They were very cautious.
Very cautious, very apprehensive of anything that might be asked. You know, who knows? People have been dying to own a share of Ford Motor Company for years.
Mm-hmm.
Now they got a chance. They were going to, you know, you're opening Pandora's box here.
Right. That's what they thought.
Yeah, exactly. And Ernie was very apprehensive about it. And I think putting it under the umbrella of Crusoe with all the other car divisions was a good way of hiding the fact that it was operating in the red. Well, we never divulge profits by divisions. This all comes under our car and truck,
right,
and they are making a profit.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that you know, we got, the timing was just bad from a market point of view. While you mentioned the Edsel came out a few years later, but that was during a slump in the middle and high-priced market. Our car would have survived. I think there's no question about it. Our car would have survived, especially with the entry of the four-door.
Mm-hmm.
But internally, the pressure's none. As I say, I wasn't here to battle for my own cause. And we got swallowed up, one, by Crusoe's aggressiveness,
mm-hmm,
and secondly, by really fear of the shareholders, meaning of operating a division that wasn't operating in the black.
So even though Breach had been very supportive in the beginning and throughout, he finally succumbed to the apprehension that the public.
Well, when he was most supportive, of course, there really was no thought of the stock going public at that time, and I think these fears started to, you know, loom into his head at that point. And he thought, oh gee, you know, how do we explain a division that's, how do we justify a division that's in a loss? It was all justified in the paper, and that it was going to be advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was going to give a prestige to the Ford Motor Company that it didn't have with its other products. Well, that was fine internally, but he was worried about how to explain that externally.
In retrospect, it seems almost absurd that they would have been so cautious.
Yeah, but I guess they really didn't know what to expect.
They didn't know. It was their first venture.
Yeah.
And I think everybody's apprehensive about wondering what would happen.
Sure, and you know, they knew that, well, the UAW, for instance, would be shareholders, and they'd find out the books would be open, and I mean, they were just, you know, so scared of anything. Anything and everything. And plus the fact that Louis wanted to build an empire, and Louis wanted us to be part of his empire.
He was a tough customer, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a tough customer. He was a farmer, and I always felt he should have stayed on the farm, or should have stayed in charge of our trucks and tractors.
Yeah.
That he was ideally suited to that, but he was not ideally suited to luxury cars. I mean, one of the things that, you know, after the kind of, well, it was emasculated, but it was kept going for a while under Crusoe, and I was a group vice president, I guess, and I had Lincoln and Continental Division. It was kind of absurd because I was still general manager of Continental, so I reported to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And in turn up to Louis Crusoe, and my brother Ben had Mercury, what subsequently was the Edsel,
right,
and another one in there, maybe not. Maybe it was just.
I think that was it. Yeah.
I think that was it. Yeah. And Louis' idea of identifying all the cars under sort of a corporate umbrella, was to take the hood ornaments and encase them in plastic and have a round plastic hood ornament with the insignia of that particular car line on there. And I blew my stack at that. And I said, you're not taking my Continental Star and sticking that in any two-bit plastic casing and putting, oh, yes, I am. I said, like hell you are. We had terrible, but it was petty stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, this was his idea of really classy. Put everything with a plastic hood ornament on it with the insignia encased in the plastic. And I said, you're going to do that on a $10,000 car, you know. And I, without really, because he was a, well, first of all, he outranked me, and he was had a lot more experience than I did. But, you know, I just wanted to tell him, you have no idea what a class car should be. I mean, right. And he didn't.
I never did.
No.
So the steps leading up to the, demise, as you say, was first absorption by a larger divisional setup.
Right.
So you became part of the Lincoln Continental Group.
Yeah.
Reporting to the group vice president.
Right. Yeah. Right.
The what was the next step after that? Well, by this time you've gotten back to were you back to in harness? Healed. And
yeah, I was back in harness, getting around fairly well.
But your heart wasn't in it because you could see what was coming.
Well, I mean, it was a fait accompli at that time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even though it had been announced.
You know, but it was all set that we were going to be, you know, swallowed up and probably eventually dissolved.
Mm-hmm. At this point, what was the next step in the infighting or the corporate level that brought about the eventual demise of the Continental?
Well, it was decided by the policy committee that the Continental Division would be dissolved.
Now, how did that come about? What were the arguments for and against it?
Well, I tell you the truth, that when those arguments were taking place, I really wasn't present at too many.
You were still convalescent?
Yeah, I was still laid up.
But you, of course, got reports from time.
Oh, I got reports, and, you know, I got upset, and I tried to talk to my brother, and he was traveling all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I really never had any satisfactory conversations with him.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, Crusoe really had his ear.
He did it.
Yeah, 100%.
And Breach was going along with it also.
And Crusoe was literally traveling with my brother and going around, and so, mm-hmm. you know, I trying to crack that was impossible. I never got my licks in at all to defend the case. Of the final meeting where the resolution was made to dissolve the division, you know, I had...
Was it a policy committee meeting?
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. And I, you know, I had my, you know, my day in court. I mm-hmm. guess I had about 5 minutes to explain my case. Well, the die was all cast.
Oh, I see.
The vote was cast. I voted no. I made sure the secretary made due note of the fact that I'd voted no.
Uh-huh.
And I remember handing, because I was, I mean, again, on crutches and in a cast. I was sitting in the back of the room with my leg up, and, you know, all those in favor, everybody, you know, opposed. Me in the background, I remember Henry turning around and looking at me, oh, that's Bill.
But you made the point to the secretary that you
were I said yes, and I want that duly recorded. There's a nay vote on this. But
well, must have been particularly galling to you at this point.
I hated it. I felt I had the heart cut out of me at that point. I mean, I really did. And I felt so badly for, you know, all the people that had worked for me in the division. And, you know, how do you tell them? Because, I mean, their reasons for, you know, why it should continue were obviously the same as mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't give them a good reason why it shouldn't mm-hmm. be in existence.
Yeah.
But, you know, it had been decided that, and that was about it.
It was a real fait accompli.
Yeah.
You felt it when you came in the room.
No question.
Yeah.
I mean, this was kind of the purpose of the meeting, is, you know, okay, we're going to dissolve the Continental Division today. So, I mean, my protest was symbolic and nothing else. Uh-huh. I was hoping it would be something else, but I kind of knew down deep it wasn't going to be.
Now, what date was that? Do you remember?
It must have been the middle of 56.
That soon?
Yeah, I'd guess July or August of 56.
There was some discussion at the time since then of those who perhaps weren't there about the price of the car. Ernie thought that $10,000, Ernie and Louie thought the $10,000 car was just way out of line and nobody would buy it. Do you remember any talk about that?
I personally don't remember any discussions about that. No, I really don't. I you know, again, maybe it was trying to put it on a profitable basis on paper that, you know, if we reduced the price of it and increased the volume, well, that was fine, except that was totally contrary to what what our mandate was, really, from these same people. So say the ground rules changed as we went along. Mine didn't, but theirs did.
Would you have agreed to that if that had been
proposed? No, no, no.
So you stuck to your guns and stood your ground. Did you say for a time there was a sort of an a cooling off period where the Continental was continued, I think, until
we ran a 57 model.
Right.
Just going through the motions. Really? We knew there was not going to be a car to follow it up. Mm-hmm. We knew there was never going to be a 58. The four-door model that I alluded to earlier, that was scrap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were just winding down. That was all.
Must have been demoralizing for all of you.
It was.
To continue.
Sure. And everybody at that point, you know, that worked for me was kind of, where do I go from here?
Right.
You know, where do I get a job? And I don't blame them, and I tried to absorb as many as I could over in the design center, but, you know, a lot of people obviously didn't fit in that category.
Something occurred to me at this point in time, probably irrelevant to what we're talking about, but I'm interested in knowing your relationships with people like George Walker and Gene Borden, and George Walker especially, apparently something of an adversarial situation.
Well, George was kind of a unique personality. Totally a good designer, had good people for him. His two henchmen, Elwood Engel and Joe Orris, were very accomplished designers.
Mm-hmm. Henchman's a good word.
Pardon?
Henchman is a good word.
Yeah, well, they were. But, you know, George had an ego that wouldn't fit in this office.
Mm-hmm.
And very flamboyant kind of a guy. No practical business sense at all.
And not much design experience either.
Really not. Mm-hmm. Really not. Yeah. You know, he made his name with Henry with the 49 Ford.
Mm-hmm. It turns out to be largely by other hands.
Yeah, sure. But, you know, George was... He'd let Elwood and Joe and the other guys do all the work, but George would take all the credit for anything that was done. The only thing that I could ever see that he ever did was draw initials. You'd go into his office and he'd have a great big pad and a grease pencil and he'd be doing your monogram. What do you think of this? Oh, it's wonderful, George, you know. And then he would start talking about somebody else and he'd be sketching their initials and a monogram would stick on the door of a car. And that's about, you know, that was about his contribution. As far as I could see, he was great at doing initials.
This great picture that you used in a styling booklet, it shows yourself in a characteristic carefree mood. Your legs are crossed, your arms are akimbo, and you're leaning against the desk, looking toward the camera and smiling. And behind you, just to your right, is a resplendent George Walker with this marvelous iridescent smile. And yet it seems a bit empty because the point where things aren't going so well. Then there was
George was a bit empty.
Then there was Elwood Engel, the angular, spectral looking character standing in the middle of the room, looking glaring at the camera. And then Gene Bordenay is sitting on the couch behind with his usual grin, as if he knew what was going on. And,
probably did.
And then a few other guys around, Buskers and one or two others. But I've always wondered. If you remember that particular occasion.
Vaguely, now that you mention it, I vaguely do. George was a consultant, as you know, for the company.
Yeah.
And then after the demise of the Continental, I had quite a few talks with Henry about, you know, what did I want to do?
Mm-hmm.
And I said I wanted to stay in the design, that I felt that, you know, that's number one, where I had the most interest, and secondly, I thought it was where I could contribute the most.
Right.
And it was something that really turned me on. But gee, you can't do that. And I said, oh, why can't I? Well, Louis Crusoe's got all that same old thing. And you know, Louis at that point had built himself a literally secret office over in the design center.
Uh-huh.
Oh yeah, where you had to push the paneling on the door and the door would pop open. If you walked down the hall, you'd never know there was a door there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he'd build an office there, and he'd build a product planning staff.
Mm-hmm.
And he had design and product planning under his thumb. And Henry said, no, you can't have that, it's Louis. How would you like international? I don't want international.
Mm-hmm.
The kids were just young and growing
sure.
up and in school, and I said, no, I don't want to go overseas. I have no interest in that at all. Well, this kept up for a little while, and, you know, I guess nature took over. Mm-hmm. Louis had a heart attack.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd hate to say it, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Providential.
Yeah, really, really. I mean, he'd led my demise, and I got even.
I think a lot of people decided to relieve around the country, at least.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. You know, I didn't know it at the time, but boy, the playback I started getting in, you know, later years, he was a tyrant.
Mm-hmm.
And even my brother finally caught on to his act, but, you know, that took a little while, too. He couldn't believe it when I was telling him, but
mm-hmm.
when other people started to report to him, I guess he started to go along with it. But one of the things that I inherited in the design center was George Walker.
Uh-huh.
And as I said, George was flamboyant, flashy dresser, perpetual tan, cared more about his appearance than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever, in the course of your taking down memoirs of people, you might talk to George Haviland about, because he had to deal with, from a public relations point of view.
I'd like to, if you have no
objection. Oh, no, I think it'd be great, and I think he could add an awful lot of insight. He, through no fault of his own, got to know George better than anybody. He had yeah, and he, you know, if George had to make a speech, George Walker had mm-hmm. to make a speech, George Haviland would be stuck with the job of, you know, of writing the speech for him. And George's command of the English language was something to behold, too. He was trying to talk about artisans that he had working. He kept calling them artesians. They were all digging wells out there. But he had, you know, more malaprops than he could shake a stick at. He didn't know what the words were or anything else. And George Haviland would write him a little crib sheet of words that he could use. So if anybody, some press guy or something, happened to stop him, George could reach in. He'd pull out this sheet that he'd fit in the palm of his hand. He had these buzzwords written down and what they meant. He'd go into some dissertation that probably didn't make any sense, but had a lot of good words in it. It just double talk. But, you know, he was, I his contributions, personally, I think were pretty minimal.
Yeah.
You know, whether he had a good name in the industry as a designer, I don't know. I think the feeling was that having George Walker as your chief stylist added some prestige to the company.
Mm-hmm.
Whether in fact it did or not, I really don't know. I, because I was so close to him, I couldn't see where it would, but, you know, on the other hand, maybe he had another image outside of, certainly as far as I was concerned.
We certainly rode the success of the 49 Ford for a number of years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
It was hard to shoot him down.
Yeah, and he, well, I say he again took credit for it, but these futuristic show cars that we did.
Yes.
You know, he would always take credit for those. Now, whether Elwood did them or Joe or
right.
whoever, something else again, but George would always be in the forefront.
Right.
And, you know, I like the one that ended up as the Batmobile and, you know,
the something. Futura.
Yeah, the Futura,
right.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. And he had one that was the X100 that was a, oh, gee, I don't know.
We still have it over the museum.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, kind of
yeah.
a jet engine type thing, big round
right.
ports on the thing and
yeah.
and that kind of stuff. So there was a very, you know, flamboyant, and maybe the fact that maybe he was able to convey the point to the press that Ford was looked into the future as far as design goes.
Mm-hmm.
And that may have been his contribution.
There was that incredible Time magazine cover. I don't know who engineered it, but it was called the Cellini of Chrome.
Yeah. That was
he
a, yeah.
took great pride in that.
Well, I don't think he knew what it meant.
No. He obviously didn't. He didn't understand the ironic implications.
Of course. Of course.
And I'm sure that Time did that tongue in cheek.
Oh, I'm sure they did, but. Oh, I don't know how many hundred copies of Time he had around his office.
Right.
You know, he passed about as same as calling cards, you know.
Right. Well, then your relationship as his real and superior then must have been a bit dicey at
times. Yeah, it was because he didn't really have a grasp of kind of what was going on.
Yeah.
You mentioned talking about that photograph that it was. Gene Bordenave sitting on a couch kind of,
right.
Maybe understanding what was going on.
Yeah.
Gene did. When finally Henry caught on to George's act and said, we got to get rid of that guy. And I'm saying, yeah, I've been trying to tell you that for years.
You never listened to the younger brother.
Oh, no. But, who's going to succeed him? I think in everybody's mind around here, except mine, Joe Orris was going to be the successor. Elwood may have been better, and I say may have, as a designer. Joe was much better businessman, much better organized, knew how to run a styling department, knew how to set up a budget. And, George had no clue as to what any of that was about, and Elwood was a little more along George's line, although Elwood had a lot more design talent than George had.
Right.
I'd always had my eye on Gene Bordenave. Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought he was a good combination of both. And I remember, I think we were going down to an annual shareholders meeting, and somebody had a blue paper for my signature as to who George Walker's successor was going to be, announced. Mm-hmm. And they had one with Joe Orris, and they had one with Gene Bordenave. I was always, saying Gene Bordenave, and everybody else was kind of talking Joe Orris.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was Henry said, well, it's your decision to make. I said, that's very simple. I took the Gene Bordenave and signed the paper. And that was that.
And he seemed to embody all of the qualities that you wanted at that time.
Yeah.
He was a good administrator, had some sense of fitness of design.
Exactly.
And was someone who they could look up to in terms of
But Gene, appearance. Gene had a good design background. I mean, he was a true professional designer. And he'd been through the ropes here at the company, and he'd been through the Harley Earl School of Design, and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a good administrator, and we needed. I mean, that design center was. I was almost embarrassed when every year we'd have to come up with our budget because it was so nebulous. Nobody really had a handle on it. Mm-hmm. But Gene was good at that. Gene
yes.
had a handle and was mm-hmm. good at cost control and
good at personnel.
Good at personnel, exactly.
And recognizing good people in advance.
Right. And Gene had a flair about him too, which was great.
Yeah.
And
a delightful companion to him.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Delight to work with, and just a fine person all the way around. Our relationship was great. I enjoyed working with Gene. I was so delighted that that I was able to make Gene George's successor and not have to, for a change, listen to what all the Einsteins up here told me I should do.
So. In effect, you were able then finally to exert your own philosophy and influence on the design of the cars.
Right.
And that has remained to this day that you're still very much interested in.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Styling and design. And
yeah, I think I'm probably more heavily into it really right now than I have been in a long time.
But
because of the new trend in Ford Motor Company product designs.
Which has been very exciting in the last 5 years.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
I'd like to get into that if we could just. Obviously, the demise of the Continental and all the attendant political maneuvering that went on must have been a crushing blow. But you obviously recovered and went on to a more congenial operation in the product and design field. Chief of it.
Yeah, I've fortunately still have the job as chairman of the design committee.
Right.
And again, fortunately, it's a very small committee. There are only four of us that are members of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I think it should be when you pick out a design for a car.
More larger. Than
Mr. Peterson,
mm-hmm.
Poling,
mm-hmm.
Don Kopka,
mm-hmm.
and myself.
Right.
And we have, depending on, you know, who's making the presentation, if it's North America, then Lou Ross and some of his people will be in there. If it's the truck people will be in there. But we are the only members of the committee, and we ultimately make the decisions. I think an interesting transition's taken place. Maybe starting with the Thunderbird of 83, I guess,
mm-hmm.
with, you know, what we're calling the aerodynamic look, which in fact it is. Cars like the Mark II and really most post-war cars had the big engines, so in the classic cars like the Mark II, you had a justification for a long hood.
Mm-hmm.
All the classic cars, maybe that's a pretty encompassing statement, but certainly most of the classic cars dating way back into the 20s and on, were all long hood jobs. And of course, they had V12s, mm-hmm. V16s in some cases. Yeah, they deemed it, exactly. It was functional. Then along comes the oil crunch of the 70s. And here's the automobile industry with really no fuel-efficient small engines. And we're still predominantly into 8-cylinder cars. And then all of a sudden we start redesigning engines. And we come up with 4-cylinder engines that are now mounted east-west instead of the traditional north-south way of mounting. So you don't have a justification for a long hood anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You got a 4-cylinder job that's going sideways. And this is kind of, you know, what I think has led to the aerodynamic look of today's car. And it's an old cliche, but it's a matter again of form following function, and it literally has. And our wind tunnel tests have proven that the more aerodynamic the shape, the better the fuel economy. And as you know, we're very conscious of fuel economy, having to meet the federal standards. And so you're seeing a whole new school of design. And really, it's been as far as I could tell, it's the first new school of design that's come since World War II. After World War II, you got rid of fenders, kind of per se. You got rid of running boards. Bumpers became more integrated, but then there really was nothing dramatic. There were all different refinements. Then we got into a kind of a glitzy, gimmicky era in the 50s and 60s with the robin's egg colors, the portholes, the fins, excessive use of chrome, but no real basic change in the style of the car, just a way of gimmicking the thing up, which, you know, I thought was, I guess I'm a purist, that just offended me. I mean, I hated every part of that style of design. But now I think we're back to functional design again, albeit with different proportions. And I think it's exciting because, with the advent of what we're able to do now with curved glass, for instance, the roof of the car really is sort of becoming an extension of the hood. You've got a sloping hood that's coming up to a fast windshield, and it's almost evolving into almost a straight line, maybe a curved line. But instead of the lines of demarcation were very pronounced in the old school of design, where you had a long hood, and that was one area of the car, and you had a fairly vertical windshield, and then you had the passenger compartment. They're all sort of melding into one now. And I think, to go back a ways, it's been tried before, but again, it's a question of proportion. I mean, you go back to the old Chrysler Airflow. I know we're talking, in the 30s, I guess.
30s.
That was an attempt at it, but the hood was too long. The proportions were wrong. It needed, a shorter hood to make that line a pleasing, flowing line. To go to the opposite extreme, you had the VW Beetle. Well, it looked like it had run into a wall. I mean, it was crushed.
Mm-hmm.
And you need a reasonable wheelbase like we have on, starting with the T-Bird, and then up to today's Taurus and Sable that we've got on the market now. you need a wheel, a sufficient wheelbase, not too much like they had in the Chrysler Airflow, and not too little like they had in the VW Beetle, but the right wheelbase so that you can get a pleasing line that doesn't necessarily have to be long hood the way cars did in the past. And I think that's where the future is evolving in the shape of cars to come, that aerodynamics are really going to play a much more important part, and we're able to do so much more, well, with the, some of the exotic metals that are coming out of it, the space age stuff. And, you know, as I say, again, it's going to be proportion. I guess the fashions change, but good taste doesn't change.
No.
And it's a question of proportion, I think, to make it good taste. And I think we've, at least for the moment, struck on a, you know, a very happy solution to the whole thing, where we've gotten, I think, very pleasing lines, and certainly the public acceptance to us, where I think they were a little skeptical when the first T-Birds came out. Tempo Topaz, but now it's catching on, and I think we're the leaders, and I'm delighted to see, you know, Ford Motor Company leading in the design field.
Change.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you harken back briefly to that that watershed period where obviously you reached a dead end in the late 70s in styling, and they looked clunky and old hat, and people were getting tired, and you needed fresh blood. And with Peterson and your just retired chairman
Phil Caldwell
and yourself, and presumably with Henry's okay, that you begin to look at new types of a new breed of designers,
mm-hmm.
like Jack Tomac,
mm-hmm.
and to allow them to look, we've got to have something fresh and new.
Right.
Is that how it happened, more or less?
Yeah, I think, and I think, you know, fortunately Don Peterson's product oriented as
mm-hmm.
as the chairman, which is, you know, it's a great help to me because, and I mean, I'm not trying to overemphasize my role, but
mm-hmm.
to have somebody on the design committee who's not strictly a cost-conscious person,
right.
but who's
yeah.
aware of product and likes product and
right.
likes the aesthetics, and I think he is the one that that really gave the Telnax and the North American designers their head to go ahead and
right.
come up with something new. I mean, we... The one dinosaur that keeps sticking in there and people love it is the Lincoln Town Car. I mean, it's the, you know, the same old box that we had for years and years, and you're talking about that, you know, those old designs of the 70s.
You come in despite embarrassment, you don't dare get rid of it. So
can't get rid of it. We got too many orders. It makes nothing but money, so, you know, why? If it ain't broken, don't fix it. So there is a market for that,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, we've got a facelift on the boards. It'll be out a year or so. That where it still is there won't be any mistaking the fact it's a Lincoln Town Car. It'll still be brought up to date and look a lot better than it does. But, you know, that's the aberration. The norm is the kind of cars that we've been talking about with the Birds and the Tempo Topazes and the Taurus Sables.
Well, this
and
was,
I,
this
you know, I think Jack... I'll go back to what I said earlier. I think the oil crunch of change in engine design really has
mm-hmm.
led to help the designers come up with a new school of design.
Right. You had the situation where retiring Gene Wardenay had pretty much run the whole operation, and apparently this time a decision was made, perhaps at your behest, to come up with an operating group like NAD, or North American Design, and
right.
then come up with a... But to continue the vice presidential office for design and selected Don Kopka, was that pretty much your decision?
The decision to split it up really wasn't mine. Not that I had any objection to it,
no.
but it was not my idea.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was to make North American Automotive Operations
right.
a more integrated unit, and the design probably should fall within their purview, and I
mm-hmm.
couldn't take any issue with that.
Yeah.
I do, as it's turned out, I like the way it's working out, because you've got Don Kopka and his staff, and they've got a lot of advanced design.
Marvelous things going on.
Absolutely. And they've got Argea Studios over in Italy.
I'm glad you picked them back up.
Yeah, exactly. And they make a real contribution,
yes.
both to Ford of Europe and Ford North America.
Yes.
And so it's worked out very nicely.
Good.
Yes. And the two complement each other very well. And when it comes to, well, we're looking at now the, it'll be a 1990 successor to the Mark.
Mm-hmm.
And, gee, there's an exciting car that's on the boards right now that I can't wait to get over there and take another look at it and see how it's coming along, because it, and it's done by a very young man. I was surprised. They showed us some renderings, 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of this as the new Mark? Well, they were abominable. And I told Jack that. I said, he said, well, you know, we've researched this. Well, he didn't say this, but they have one of the product planners. We've researched this and we've done this, and the car's been very well accepted, and, you know, we like it. And so keep your remarks down to a minimum, and we can change a few things, but it's pretty well set. So I said, well, I'll keep my remarks down to a minimum. It stinks. And I said, I don't know how more succinct I can be. And Peterson Poling looked at me, and they agreed with me. And so, okay, back to the drawing board. And they went back to the drawing board, and we had to hurry the meetings because our time schedule was compressed on the thing. And we came back with some full-size renderings, and gee, there was one there that was a knockout. I mean, I think it's a very logical progression. I'm not particularly in love with the Mark 7 that's on the road now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, if I can go personalize it again, I think it would be a wonderful 1990 extension of the Mark II, so to speak. But a very up-to-date car, and I asked Jack Telnack, I said, God, I think, boy, you're really on the right track with this one. This is a knockout. Who did it? Well, it was the son of one of the guys who went to graduate from Art Center at the same time Jack Telnack did. And this kid is, I think he's 27 years old, and boy, he's a crackerjack.
He's on staff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's on the North American staff, and I was delighted to see, a kid that's that young. Of course, I'm talking like an old man now. I was that young myself when I did the Mark II, but he's able to grasp the feel of that car and yet keep it totally modern and exciting design.
So the current direction is obviously with your approval and with your impetus, and of course fits in with your feelings about new and exciting directions in design.
Yeah, I think cars are taking a new shape, and again, I think it's a question of function again. As I say, we're always gonna have to try and keep a pleasing proportion to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you've noticed. I mean, the difference in the front ends of cars and the way they used to be. The radiators virtually disappeared. The grills, and
right.
Now they're hidden down. And
yeah,
there are so many things that are really, the whole car is becoming so much more integrated. I think we have to pay particular attention. It's a phase that we haven't talked about it at all, and one that probably doesn't really should get there now is interiors, though.
Mm-hmm.
And I think interiors are a vital part of automotive design.
But the direction of the company in the next 10 years is pretty much, 5 years at least, pretty much set.
Right.
And it's a logical, exciting extension of what you've been
doing. I think so. I'm very enthused about it.
Good.
Very enthused about
That's
it.
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Ford. That's been delightful.
Oh, pleasure.
We're very appreciative of your giving us this interview.
My favorite topic.